President Yoon's administration has been increasingly influenced by Japan as well as the United States. The strengthening of the military alliance is very dangerous.
The official armistice anniversary is July 27th. Through this week, various events, including in Washington, D.C., will address replacing the armistice with a peace treaty and seeking better ties with Pyongyang. Frank Smith, Seoul.
After a call by Hezbollah chief Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, Lebanese worshippers took to the streets after noon prayers on Friday to protest the desecration of the Holy Quran.
I demand for the government of the Lebanon to expel the embassy of Sweden embassy for our dignity and prosperity.
Our protest is to defend and secure our Holy Quran and all the holies, starting from hijab, prayers and adhan, and all the holy sites, including the cause and the only cause of all Arab and Muslims, which are the cause. It's Syria and the Quran.
We want to defend our Quran, and we don't want anyone to violate our holy book.
In a speech on Thursday, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, denounced the Swedish government for allowing such sacrilegious acts to take place on its territory and stressed that all Arab and Muslim states need to follow in the footsteps of Iraq and expel the Swedish ambassadors.
If all the Arab and Muslim countries withdrew their ambassadors from Sweden and asked the Swedish ambassadors in our countries to leave, then what would happen to Sweden and its government and its interests? Boycotting products is a good step, but it's not enough to teach them a lesson. When they see that their interests are at stake and the Arab and Muslim countries are not too weak to take this step, then they would be forced to resolve this issue.
Nasrallah also called on the Lebanese government to adopt a firm stance against Sweden and asked the worshippers and mourners attending Muharram processions to commemorate the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein to always carry a copy of the Quran to show the world that they are ready to sacrifice their lives for the sake of protecting the holy book.
Today we have gathered to fulfill the call by His Eminence the Secretary General Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, who is the great-grandson of Prophet Muhammad, to whom God sent the Quran. We tell Sweden and the entire world that our Quran is Al-Quds. It is our dignity, and we will defend the Quran with all our power until they learn to respect it.
It is our duty to preserve God's religion and the messages He has sent us. To denounce the violation of the Quran, we came here today to say that this is our constitution. And we call on everyone, be they Christian, Druze, Sunni, Shiite, no matter what their sect or their Arab or Muslim nationality, to stand with us.
Several Muslim countries have already summoned Sweden's ambassadors or its charge d'affaires to protest the second incident of state-authorized desecration of the Holy Quran in the Swedish capital.
Lebanese protesters have stressed that the Holy Quran is not only a divine book which introduces Islamic teachings, it is also a book which represents humane values for all mankind. People here today say they are steadfast in defending the Holy Quran against any sacrilegious act. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Afghan female school graduates are shedding tears of dismay after their exclusion by the Taliban rulers from the university entrance exam, also known as Concur. They have been studying hard for the national test in order to pursue higher education. But all that has been in vain, as the Taliban have announced that only male students can sit for the exam this year.
I wanted to pursue my higher education and become a leader and serve my people. But now they say that girls cannot take the university entrance exam. This is unfair and unjust. I am so sad and feel like my life is over.
I wanted to enroll in medical university and become a professional doctor and help my country prosper. But unfortunately, the Taliban shut the doors on our dreams and future and denied us our rights.
In a new report, UN human rights experts say the Taliban authorities have increased restrictions on women and girls in Afghanistan in recent months. The UN has urged the Taliban to respect and protect the rights of all Afghans, especially women and girls, and to ensure their access to education, healthcare, and other essential services.
With all these restrictions on women in place, Afghanistan's future is looking increasingly bleak. Girls and women are losing hope as they are being excluded from all political, social, and educational spheres.
The Taliban have not given any clear indication of when or if girls will be able to resume their studies at high schools or universities. They say they are upholding women's rights in accordance with their interpretation of Sharia law and Afghan culture. No other Muslim country in the world imposes such restrictions on women's education. The fate of Afghan girls remains uncertain as they are being barred from most educational settings. For many of them, education not only is a source of knowledge, but also a source of hope and empowerment. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Iranians from all walks of life once again out on the streets, chanting slogans and using the strongest terms to express their anger.
Protesters rallied in the Iranian capital, Tehran, after the Friday prayers, along with a number of other major cities across the country, to condemn the desecration of the Holy Quran.
The protesters also called on the foreign ministry to cut ties with Sweden. This is the second time in less than a month that an Iraqi refugee in Stockholm has committed the sacrilegious act with protection from Swedish police.
No one should allow themselves to insult our religious beliefs. This is absolutely unacceptable.
We just had to take part in this rally to get our voices heard.
The Swedish government has allowed this to happen, and we are here to express our anger.
We are here for our holy book, for our religion.
Later in the day, protesters once again gathered outside the Swedish embassy in Tehran, demanding the ambassador to leave the country.
It's the second time this is happening, so we should definitely show a stronger reaction.
Iranians are very well aware of the consequences of such blasphemous acts. That is why you see so many of us here.
We will not stop until the Swedish ambassador leaves our country.
This is exactly what we want our officials to do. The foreign ministry has to expel the ambassador, and we will continue these rallies until he leaves.
The Iranian foreign ministry summoned the Swedish ambassador to Tehran on Thursday, but the protesters are now calling for the expulsion of the ambassador. They are planning another rally in front of the foreign ministry in the coming days, demanding Iran to cut ties with Sweden. Gizem Shahmadi, Tehran.
Iranian Minister of Justice Amin Hossein Rahimi arrived in Damascus and met with his Syrian counterpart, Ahmad al-Sayed. The two officials underlined the importance of uniting efforts legally and judicially to face unjust lawsuits filed in international entities by the United States and its Western allies against member countries of the Resistance Alliance, as well as working together to lift unjust sanctions on both countries. An initial agreement has been reached to form a joint legal committee for this purpose.
We will be signing a memorandum of understanding on exchanging expertise and organizing workshops. Western countries claim they respect international law while they are the ones who violated the most. This is also the situation in northeast Syria. They loot Syria's oil, wheat, and cotton. Those are crimes committed against international law and UN Charter. There should be a legal deterrent. International law should be implemented.
The Iranian official also met with Syria's foreign minister Faisal al-Maqdad. They discussed ways to improve the historic relations between the two countries in service of both peoples. Rahimi said political and military relations between the two countries reached their highest levels during the war on Syria, reiterating the need to bolster economic and judicial partnerships.
The main focus of my visit is proposing to form a joint legal committee between Syria and Iran and other member countries of the Resistance Alliance to create a defense line against lawsuits filed against us by the enemies, and also to legally work to force the hegemonic regimes to compensate for the losses they inflicted on Syria, especially on its infrastructure. We should demand that in international entities.
Rahimi also visited Syria's People's Assembly, where he met with its speaker, Hamoud Sabbagh. The top Iranian official said his country will continue assisting the Syrian people, mainly in reconstructing what war had destroyed. Syrian and Iranian officials are keen on continuously exchanging visits in a show of serious willingness to further boost bilateral cooperation in all fields. This visit aims to develop judicial collaboration to match the political strategic ties between the two states. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Rush hour, Washington, D.C. Protesters assemble for demonstrations at a busy intersection.
We want 48!
A second day of demonstrations, timed to coincide with the second day of Israeli President Isaac Herzog's U.S. visit, included a joint address to Congress. His reaffirmation of a binding relationship between the U.S. and Israel was not kindly received by everyone.
It's a moral imperative. As an American citizen, where $3.8 billion of our tax money is going to fund apartheid and racism, death and imprisonment for people, is something I, as an American citizen, need to speak out against.
Herzog characterized a true friendship between the allies, his relationship with the U.S. troubling to those embarked upon continued human rights abuses of Palestinians.
Our people in the homeland and outside of the homeland continue to suffer from being bombed, whether it's in the Gaza Strip, or raids in the West Bank, for example, like with what's happened in Jenin, or even in 48 Palestine, with what's happening, for example, in certain poor Palestinian cities.
Protesters have been standing out here for hours, temporarily shutting down this busy D.C. intersection. Passersby occasionally honk their horns to show support for the demonstrators. These protesters are worried about several issues, including more Israeli settlements in the occupied bank and a potential judicial overhaul headed by Benjamin Netanyahu's regime that could give political allies control over the appointment of judges.
Judaism is a religion of 3,000 years to be subservient to God, and Zionism is a takeover. It's a transformation to nationalism. It based political, selfish, flawed nationalist movement.
What do we want?
Justice!
What do we want it?
Now!
If we don't get it,
shut it down!
Observers have long accused Israel of being human rights in the occupied West Bank. A 2021 report by Human Rights Watch said Israel's policies amount to apartheid and persecution. Colin Campbell, Washington.
Fifty leaders from the EU and CELAC countries gathered in Brussels on Monday and Tuesday in what was the first summit of its kind for 8 years. CELAC consists of 33 nations in Latin America and the Caribbean. Prime Minister of St. Vincent and the Grenadines, Ralph Gonsalves, is currently CELAC president. He says the war in Ukraine and sanctions against Russia have brought misery to millions of citizens.
Rising prices, shortages of goods, and it's not just the war. It's the sanctions upon the war, price of fuel, of food, borrowing of monies and so on.
Gonsalves certainly wasn't the only leader to tell EU decision makers that peace negotiations are needed to end the war in Ukraine.
La guerra de Ucrania.
The war in Ukraine must come to an end. The European Union and CELAC must, as an obligation, look for a way towards peace. We cannot live with this nightmare that any day now may see all hell break loose on all of us.
It was clearly an uncomfortable event for EU leaders as they wanted to focus on securing new energy supplies and critical raw materials in order to further isolate Russia and become less dependent on China. The visiting leaders refused to blindly follow the EU's anti-Russia rhetoric, analysts point out.
They're much more willing to call out what they see as the hypocrisy of great powers, you know, talking about other great powers and how they bully small states, given the histories of colonialism and American imperialism within Latin America.
The EU did manage to sign trade deals with Chile, Argentina and Uruguay on the sidelines of the summit. However, the relentless criticism of the 27-nation bloc's support for the war continued.
The world has spent $2.24 trillion to fuel the war machine that only causes death, destruction and even more hunger. This summit is a way for us to say enough with that. Another world is possible.
Not only have calls here on EU leaders to facilitate peace negotiations fallen on deaf ears, but later this week EU foreign ministers will meet to agree on ways to apply more pressure on Russia while providing additional support to Ukraine. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Money in exchange for stopping Tunisians from leaving the country. That's the core of the Memorandum of Understanding sealed in Tunis on Sunday by the outgoing Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte and Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni under the supervision of the European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen. Actually, the memorandum is rather vague on financial figures. Some media have reported that the deal is worth 1 billion euros. Others say that the figures stipulated could change according to developments on the ground. What has emerged so far is that the EU intends to provide 105 million euros to Tunis to curb irregular migration. According to the European Coast Guard agency Frontex, there were more than 100,000 illegal border crossings through the central Mediterranean last year, a 50% rise compared to 2021, with Italy struggling to cope with this surge in arrivals.
We want real equality and do not want sympathy without respect. Today we need a collective agreement on inhuman migration and on the displacement processes behind which criminal networks hide. The world has been divided in two, half for the rich and half for the poor. It is no longer possible for this monetary system to continue in the same form and content. This global monetary system creates darkness wherever it wants.
Tunisia, together with Libya, is considered one of the main gateways for asylum seekers who wish to reach European shores. The country has often been described by Western media as being in a state of financial malaise following the COVID-19 pandemic, rising inflation, high unemployment, and a worldwide swell in commodity prices.
According to some EU leaders, Brussels should make the Cash for Migrant Control Accord with Tunisia a model for similar deals with other countries. The EU has reportedly been in talks with Egypt on a similar agreement.
The partnership with Tunisia has to be considered as a model for building new relations with North African neighbours. All these, a few months ago, would have been unthinkable.
The EU is also willing to put on the table a substantial package of macro-financial assistance to, quote, support Tunisia's fragile economy and prevent the situation from spiraling out of control. Tunisian President Sayed has repeatedly rejected what he calls diktats of the international financial institutions, which have tried to persuade Tunisia to remove state subsidies on basic goods, such as fuel and bread. Sayed has said these measures will only lead to more poverty and are unacceptable. Max Civili, Rome.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
According to figures recently released, Britain's inflation didn't budge at all in May, remaining at a higher-than-expected 8.7%, sparking fears that rapid price rises are becoming entrenched. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Reuters news agency has covered this story and tells us more. British inflation defied expectations of a slowdown to hold at 8.7% in the month of May, putting yet more pressure on the Bank of England a day before it is predicted to raise interest rates for the 13th time in a row to tame stubborn price growth. Markets increased their bets on further rate rises following Wednesday, 21st of June's official figures, which showed that underlying inflation rose to its highest level since 1992. The headline figure means that British inflation is once again the fastest of any major advanced economy. The numbers are also uncomfortable for Prime Minister Rishi Sunak, who has pledged to halve inflation over the course of this year before a probable 2024 election, and are likely to increase mortgage costs for millions of homeowners. Economists polled by Reuters news agency had forecast that the annual consumer price inflation rate would drop to 8.4% in May, moving further away from October's 41-year high of 11.1%. Samuel Toombs, chief UK economist at Pantheon Macroeconomics, said, "May's consumer price index figures ratcheted up the pressure on the Monetary Policy Committee to increase bank rate substantially further over the coming months." Sterling briefly jumped against the US dollar and the euro after the figures were released, and two-year government bond yields, which are sensitive to interest rate expectations, rose to their highest level since July of 2008. Markets now see a 40% chance that the Bank of England will raise interest rates by half a percentage point to 5% in the coming days, rather than a quarter point move previously expected. They see a 60% chance of interest rates reaching 6% by December. Chancellor of the Exchequer Jeremy Hunt told reporters today's figures strengthen the case for the government to stick to its guns. Jeremy Hunt claimed, "If you look at what's happening in our country, you can see that rises in interest rates do bring down inflation over time. That will happen here." The website of New Straits Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. British inflation started to pick up in 2021 when many economies faced supply chain bottlenecks as they emerged from the COVID-19 pandemic, and accelerated sharply after Russia started its special operation in Ukraine in February of 2022, sending natural gas prices soaring across Europe. Inflation has been slower to fall in Britain than elsewhere, however, partly due to the timing of energy subsidies, but increasingly, too, as a result of big price rises apparently becoming embedded across swathes of Britain's economy. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, said core inflation, a measure which excludes volatile food, energy and tobacco prices, and which the Bank of England views as a good guide to underlying price pressures, unexpectedly rose to 7.1% from 6.8%, its highest level since March of 1992. Another measure of underlying pressures, services price inflation, which is heavily influenced by the fast-rising wages and Britain's tight post-pandemic job market, also reached its highest level since 1992 at 7.4%. The Office for National Statistics chief economist Grant Fitzner said the cost of airfares rose by more than a year ago and is at a higher level than usual for May. He added, rising prices for second-hand cars, live music events and computer games also contributed to inflation remaining high. Paul Dales, the chief US economist at Capital Economics, said he now forecasts that the Bank of England would raise interest rates by half a percentage point in the coming days after the latest numbers. Dales said the problem is that the recent surge in core inflation and the re-acceleration in wage growth shows that domestic inflation pressures are still strengthening. This suggests the Bank of England may have to do more work than the US Federal Reserve or the European Central Bank, the ECB. Last month, the Bank of England forecast inflation would drop to just over 5% in the final quarter of this year and fall below its 2% target in early 2025. However, British officials claim that there may be some relief on the horizon as producer price inflation slowed much more sharply than economists had expected. The British newspaper The Financial Times has also covered the same story and tells us more. New Ipsos polling conducted ahead of the interest rate increase announced on Thursday 22nd of June shows that a majority of the British people, or 78%, would describe the state of Britain's economy as poor and only 20% would describe it as good. 2 in 5, or 38%, expect the economy may get worse in 2024, while a third, or 33%, expect it to stay the same, and a quarter, or 23%, expect it to get better. 2019 GE Conservative voters are more optimistic, with 27% expecting it to get worse and slightly more, 33%, expecting it to get better. By contrast, half, or 49%, of 2019 GE Labour voters expected to get worse, and only 1 in 5, or 18%, expected to get better. 61% feel that Britain is currently experiencing an economic recession, although this is down 12 percentage points from July of 2022. Looking ahead, an equal share, 61%, say it's likely the United Kingdom will experience an economic recession in 2024. Most expect their household spending to increase within the next 6 months, with the largest share of the public expecting the cost of their food shopping to rise 75%, alongside the cost of other household shopping 72%, the cost of their utilities to rise 66%, and the overall cost of going out socialising 62%. These outlooks are not as pessimistic as they were back in May, with slightly fewer Britons expecting increases than did in May. Similar proportions expect their household spending to increase in 2024. Continue to look ahead to the remainder of 2023. 66%, or two-thirds, expect the interest rates and the rate of inflation, 64%, to rise. And half, or 49%, expect the taxes they pay to increase, and 56% expect further tax rises in 2024. Against this backdrop, the opinion poll finds that 26% expecting to see their own standard of living rise between now and the end of the year, with 30% expecting their standard of living to get worse. Meanwhile, according to a new data, Britain's economy has lost momentum again, as the growth in the private sector dropped to its lowest level for 3 months. The closely followed Standard & Poor's Global CIPS Flash UK Purchasing Managers Index declined to 52.8% in June from 54% back in May. It represented a sharp slowdown than expected, with experts having forecast a figure of 5.7% for the month, and reading above 50 is considered to show the sector is growing.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Press TV. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. Desecration of the Holy Quran will not be tolerated, is what is being said throughout the Islamic world. This after, once again, in Sweden, a man was given permission to insult and desecrate the Muslim holy book. Iran's leader of the revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said the perpetrators of this insult must be stopped. Now, Tehran has deported the Swedish ambassador from Iran and says it won't allow another one in until Sweden implement changes in allowing for the holy book to be insulted and desecrated. Why are Islamic sanctities allowed to be insulted in this way? We're going to look at all of this in this spotlight. I'd like to welcome my guests to the program. Hakim Misafi Abedia, academic and political analyst out of Tehran. And Reverend Frank Goodley, Anglican priest out of London. Thank you both for being with me. Well, let me start it off in Tehran. Why do you think that we're seeing these attacks against the Holy Quran being allowed at this time in Sweden and just the whole Islamophobia in general tolerated? This is for Tehran, Ms. Hakim Misafi Abedia.
Yes, thank you for having me. Let me say condolences on the occasion of the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, who gave his life for the preservation of the Quran and Islam. I think it is one of the perspectives that we can look at this issue is that this is a propaganda of deed happening. Propaganda has several modes. Sometimes propaganda is a talk, sometimes it is an action taken. Islamophobia basically is a sort of propaganda with an aim at, giving an idea, trying to influence the views of people in the direction of achieving some political aims. That are there. Islamophobia can be, sometimes soft, sometimes hard. This is the desecration of the Holy Quran is one of the forms of hard Islamophobia or violent Islamophobia. It is a propaganda of deed. What is the message involved here? That is, the perpetrator, which is actually the front person. With a lot of, individuals and organizations and sometimes even governments involved in the back stage. What is the message involved here? I think the message that is being given here is that it is trying to influence how people look at the Holy Quran. Is the Holy Quran a book that is there for, organizing human life? Or is it at the level of, any other text that can be dealt with in this way? So I think at the very outset, I look at it as a propaganda action, okay, as a violent propaganda action that is Islamophobic in nature.
Well, your thoughts, Reverend Frank, because if we look at from, especially from 9/11 onwards, we see this outright direct attack on Islam, Islamic values, Muslim countries. And then we have seen periodically throughout that time, especially more in recent years, various European countries allowing for this direct attack, insult, by burning the holy book of Muslims. What could be accomplished in general by allowing such like these acts to take place?
Well, it's quite clear to me that this we're witnessing a provocation, provocation aimed at angering and insulting Muslim believers. I should say that it is also, I believe, in Islamic belief that there is something called Umm al-Kitab, the mother of the book, which is kept in heaven, which is eternal and created, according to some Muslim theologians anyway. And that, but that heavenly Quran cannot be hurt, cannot be injured, cannot be affected by any action or stupid and idiotic human beings. But of course, the burning of copies of the Quran, the desecration of copies of the Quran, is aimed at angering Muslims, at provoking Muslims. It's quite clear to me. And why is it done? I think there is an element of stupidity because of idiocy, because quite clearly, what could be achieved by doing that? But maybe there is an aim, which is actually by inciting Muslims to protest, to portray Muslims as fanatics, as unable to take criticism. And so in a way, it's a plan, it's a project. By we heard the word Islamophobia, yes, let's use the word Islamophobia, but it is quite planned. And in this sense, it is an action, a provocation, which I think Muslims should resist, because we heard about 9/11, it is all aimed at portraying Islam as an intolerant fanatical faith, which is not true. Islam is a great tradition of tolerance, of rationality. And the Quran itself is a rational book, because the voice of the Quran is always arguing, giving reasons, offering reasons for particular positions. So the Quran is not an irrational book, but the irrationality here is the action of these idiots, these imbeciles who engage in these provocations. And that should be resisted, because we don't want to give weapons to the Islamophobes, so that they can go on portraying the Islamic faith as intolerant fanatical, which is not true. It's completely false. Muslims are always open to dialogue, to discussion. I myself am engaged in religious dialogue with all sorts of Muslims, but particularly with Shia Muslims. And I know their traditions of engagement, of philosophy, of rationality. So we must resist, in my opinion, these provocations, which would not do Islam any good. Now, the question of freedom of speech, which I think has been mentioned. Now, we in the West, I mean, I live in England, I live in London. It's quite clear that freedom of speech is limited. We have categories described as hate crime. If you commit hate crime, if you engage in actions or in words against a minority or a gender and so on, we have told that that is not freedom of speech. Freedom of speech is perverted.
That was actually, Reverend, you just mentioned the next question I wanted to talk about. Let me, sorry to interrupt you, cross over back to Tehran and Ms. Sakhia Birya. He just mentioned free speech, and we see that free speech is definitely very much relative everywhere, perhaps. But right now, when we see in the West and how it talks about hate speech, or we see this unbelievable wave in dealing with certain pronouns and genders and what to use and all of that. But then on the other hand, when it comes to this type of act, this desecration, it's okay. So on the one hand, Reverend Frank said that he feels these are some imbeciles, some individuals. But there are proof that a lot of these people who have done this over the years have been actually connected to either some governments or intelligent entities from various countries. I mean, your take overall on this?
Mm-hmm. Yes, of course it is organized. Of course, you know, there are many books and articles written on this Islamophobia industry. Basically, you have a myriad of people, of organizations, of networks, of think tanks, and even governmental organizations, and that are behind these sort of actions. And I think one way of looking at it is that it is actually the last sort of racism that is being tolerated and actually promoted in European and in Western countries in general, that this is one sort of racism that is there and it is tolerated very much. As you said, racism and hate crimes against a speech is counted as racism is actually labeled as a hate crime and is not tolerated. But for Muslims, it seems there is an exception. And the reason for that might be the growing power of Islam in Europe and in Western countries. You know that Islam is the fastest growing religion in Europe. And of course, it is seen as a threat. It is seen as a danger to, to the Western hegemony in terms of the civilizational hegemony that is there, the cultural hegemony that is there. The idea that the Western way of living is superior to all other ways of living. So this growth of Islam in Europe and in other Western countries, including the United States, is something that is actually bringing about these sorts of reactions. So these are, I think, reactions to the strength of Islam, not the other way around, that, you know, that Islam is weak and these people are trying to show that weakness. It is a reaction to the growing power of Islam, and it is in line with efforts to pacifying the power of Islam in Europe, the power of active Muslims who see Islam as a way of life, as a civilizational, a civilizational system of living. It is in line with that sort of, activity that is going on. As I said, part of it is hard, which we could say is a sort of terrorism, actually. It's a sort of crime against humanity that you are desecrating the identity of several billion people around the world. So this is actually showing the power of Islam. I think that is something that shouldn't be missed.
Well, Reverend, a Muslim in Sweden actually attained permission to burn the Bible and the Torah, but he didn't do it. He said he wanted to show that no holy book should be burned, and how Islam respects all monotheistic religions. I mean, your thoughts on this, doesn't this portray the opposite of what a lot of, especially we see mainstream media sometimes portraying Muslims as extremists and intolerant, but the West being very tolerant? I mean, doesn't this show the opposite, or your assessment of this?
Yes, but actually I also agree with the speaker in Tehran about the fact that a strand of Western thought tried to impose its ideology, its view of the world on the rest, on some other parts of the world, in this case we're talking about the Islamic world, as a, and pretending that there is a... I want to say, of course, that there are several strands of thinking in the West. The liberal form of Western culture is only one strand. There is also a very strong Christian strand, which stands up for eternal values, for supernatural values, or transcendence. But yes, but it is this kind of secular liberal hegemony, which is very often aimed at portraying Islam in negative terms. The famous example of this book by a French writer called Michel Houellebecq, who wrote a book a few years ago called La Soumission, which means submission in French, and pretending, creating a fantasy about an Islamic party in coalition with the left achieving power in France and creating a sort of Sharia state, a caliphate state in France. Now, that was aimed quite clearly at scaring French people by whipping up this idea that Islam is conquering, that is taking over. And again, it's also one of the dangers. I know that Islam has many converts and so on, but I mean, if one sort of exaggerates the influence of Islam, one indirectly lends support to the views of Islamophobes who are trying to say, be careful, these guys are taking over. So I think we want to resist that political temptation. But I also want to say a personal anecdote. I taught religious education in a private school many years ago. And in some occasions, I found that copies of the Bible had been desecrated. They'd been disfigured and all that. Now, those were school children. And what you can justify, because we know children sometimes are very foolish, would justify in the case, and actually they belong to a particular religious minority, which now I don't want to mention what minority it was, but there was an aim, it was deliberately aimed at offending Christianity. But school children, it came, you know, you don't get too worked up about what a child does. But these events which I was discussing are episodes by grown men, by adults who deliberately want to provoke Muslims, to show Muslims in a bad light by showing them as unable to take criticism. But burning the Quran is not criticism. I know I've engaged with religious dialogue in many years, and I know Muslims who are willing to answer sometimes criticism or aspects of a culture or religion, and equally I can take criticism about my faith, about my religion. It's part of a game. I mean, there is a passage in the Bible, in the New Testament, in the Injil, where Peter, the Apostle Peter, says, be ready to give your reason for your faith to one who asks of you. So I go back to the question of rationality, which is perfectly all right. We can engage in dialectic discussion. I know, as I said before, the Shia tradition, philosophy and all that. But that is nothing we're discussing now. We're talking about acts of provocation, acts deliberately aimed at inflaming people's hearts. And,
All right. Let me cross back over here and get... I came back in this discussion. Would you say that it is quite ironic that in the mainstream narrative, we hear that these Western countries are actually the ones that are tolerant and accepting, and then we have countries in the Islamic world that they will call either authoritarian or lacking tolerance. But you look at a country, for example, like Iran, where Jews practice freely here, Christians practice freely here, and other religions. I mean, doesn't that expose the hypocrisy of the whole narrative that is being portrayed?
Yes, of course it does. And of course, if you want to show the world that you have freedom of speech, if you know any Western country wants to show that, showcase that to the world, it is not the red lines of other cultures and other religions that you have to cross. It is the red lines of your own culture and your own country that are, you know, should be at stake. For example, you know, the criticism against some of the red lines that are, you know, every day are growing. You know, like we are seeing that there are new red lines, as you said, like, for example, in terms of homosexuality, that has become one of the new red lines in some Western countries. So, you know, this is a better test of whether these countries are tolerant and really for freedom of speech. You see, for example, a mosque being closed down in London for, you know, different basically unfounded reasons, which is actually a sign that there is no freedom of speech there, you know, in terms, at least there is no justice in terms of who has freedom of speech and who doesn't. You know, the rights of Muslims are being trampled upon in this way. They are not being allowed to practice their religion freely. And I think that is a good sign of the hypocrisy that is there.
Okay. Now, Frank, last question. You mentioned previous that we have different types of Westerners. And, of course, you were talking about the more neoliberal or liberals and then talking about the Christians. So let's talk about the Christians themselves. I mean, whether we're talking about Christians or Jews or Muslims, we as religious people have a lot more in common than not. So do you think that part of all of this with Islamophobia is basically a tactic of divide and conquer, having the people go against each other instead of concentrating on the main problems in the society, the main cause of all of this? Your assessment of that?
Yes, I mean, there is a plan, there is an intention to, if you like, divide and rule. Yes, it's an old strategy, an old technique. But, I mean, there is a concept which is central to all, certainly all monotheistic religions, or even outside monotheism, the concept of a sacred, something which is sacred. And the sacred is essential to a religious way of life, a religious consciousness. In case of Islam, of course, the Quran is a sacred text, it's a sacred book. It has to be treated with respect, to be handled with respect, and all that. In Christianity, we're talking, yes, the Gospel, but also we believe in representations of the figure of Jesus, and we have to treat them with great respect. And we find it's very insulting if someone, for example, attacks a personal accurate representation of Jesus Christ or the Virgin Mary. And in Judaism, of course, there is a strong sense of the Torah, the law of law given to Moses, and